Chapter 5 Learning Three Things. Josef Kolsko acknowledged three things in the month since the Battle of Moreland City. First, he realized he couldn't decide whether his actions during the fighting at Moreland City meant he was braver than he'd thought or stupider. Despite gut-wrenching fear, and his intent to stay as far from bullets, blades, and cannon as he could, somehow, in the heat of the battle, while the Kielanders tried to use their own small artillery pieces and the larger captured cannon against the Narthani infantry formations, he'd forgotten his fear and rushed to help organize the Kielan gunners. When he looked back at those minutes, how he'd acted didn't fit his own self-image. Episodes of cognitive dissonance recurred as his mind tried to reconcile that he had done something he couldn't imagine himself doing. If he'd witnessed anyone else behaving that way, he would have viewed the person as heroic, a view he would never have associated with Joe Kolsko. Perhaps Josef Kolsko was a different person. Brave or stupid? He found it hard to use the latter label, because what he did had been necessary. The Narthani infantry blocks had repositioned to face the clansmen. Both sides had begun serious musket fire exchanges, which would have only one outcome. The islanders weren't disciplined enough to stand against professional soldiers. The only hope, and one Josef had recognized, was to get the artillery pieces into action. Kielan gunners had tried to bring their three-barrel swivel light artillery into position, but one of the three carriages had overturned, its crew disorganized, and Josef felt sure they intended to abandon the carriage. He could only remember thinking that they needed every piece in action as soon as possible to suppress the Narthani muskets. He had no recollection of making a decision, but found himself organizing the overturned carriage crew and helping other Kielanders get the captured Narthani 12-pounder cannon into action. Now it was all a blur. He had no doubt that if they hadn't gotten the artillery into action, the Narthani would have crushed the Kielan attack and killed most of the men, including Josef, though he arrived at this judgment in hindsight. It had come down to his doing what was necessary without considering the potential cost to himself. As a result, whenever someone raised the topic of what he had done during the battle, he diverted the conversation, claimed he couldn't remember details, or he found a reason to be somewhere else. The second realization Josef came to happened gradually. But he only fully acknowledged it when he woke one morning, rolled over, and looked at Mara still sleeping. The previous evening had been one of the best he could remember. They had lingered over evening meal, her talking about plans to organize the university, him describing ideas for new projects, both of them listening intently to what the other had in mind and offering comments and suggestions at the right moments. Both of them knowing the other had truly listened. Later, they played the Anyar version of the game Go. Mara, a master at the game, had played at the snarling Greco pub with the best local players until her pregnancy progressed to where she wanted to spend evenings at home. Still, she missed playing and coerced Josef to play whenever she could. He usually obliged, though he hadn't yet won a game from her. At the pub, he felt proud of her skill and pleased to watch her intent focus when she played. Although he didn't mind her being so much better than him, it irked him that he didn't win occasionally. "You must not concentrate enough," said his wife after his third loss. "Somehow, I don't believe that's the problem," he said. "I'm concentrating as hard as I can, just to see if once I can win a game against you."
"And you would want me to lose a game now and then?" Mara asked, the smile at the corners of her mouth indicating she already knew her husband's answer.
"It would have to be a real win."
Josef paused. I don't mind losing as much as wondering how you do it. Let's play a game, and you tell me why you made each move. Maybe I can pick up some pointers, and at least make our games more interesting for you. They played again, and Mara explained her reasoning when she could. By the 20th move, it became apparent he couldn't learn how to play better.
I'm sorry, Yosef. The best moves simply seem obvious to me.
No need to be sorry. It's what I suspected. You have some of the characteristics of a savant.
A what?
Savant. A word my people use for someone with an extraordinary intellectual talent that can't be explained.
Yosef didn't tell her that another definition of savant pertained to someone with an extraordinary talent who also had a significant impairment, such as autism. Savant was the only word he could think of at the moment, and the Cadelli wouldn't know the difference.
Then you must be one too, said Mara, with all the knowledge you have.
No. I'm smart enough, but more the normal level. Having knowledge doesn't necessarily have a direct correlation with intelligence, though obviously it helps, especially in using the knowledge. If anything, I might be called a polymath, someone with broad knowledge in many areas.
So many new words, Yosef. I wonder if you'll ever run out of them. I hope you realize every time there's a new one, it makes me all the more curious about exactly where you came from.
Yosef frowned.
Now, Mara, we agreed.
No, no, said Mara, laughing. I'm not going back on our agreement. I won't press you for details of your mysterious origin. You said you'd tell me someday, if you could, and that the secrecy has nothing to do with Cadellium and its people.
As for new words, said Yosef, looking to divert the conversation from the sensitive subject, that's part of expanding knowledge. The more you know, the more you need words that weren't necessary before.
As you say, replied Mara.
So, if I'm a savant and you're a polymath, our child will be what? A treasure. A miracle.
The rest of the evening they talked of the child, of their house, of inconsequential things, all the while communicating about being together, even if they never spoke the words. As he lay in bed, looking at Mara and remembering the evening, his throat tightened, his gaze softened, and he resisted the urge to reach out to embrace her. He told himself he didn't want to wake her, but he knew it wasn't the only reason.
I love her. Yes, I liked and respected her, and the marriage was the logical thing to do. But now there's more to it. I don't know when it happened or whether it was a single event or a gradual development, but I have to admit it to myself. Yet neither of us has said the words to the other. Why don't I say them? As if I didn't know. Maybe she doesn't feel the same way. I'm sure she cares for me, but that's not the same as love. If I say them first, I'm afraid of what she'll say back. Maybe what I feel for her is only one way. It would put her on the spot. Either she'd have to admit she doesn't love me that way, or she would be obliged to pretend. What a dork I am, and I feel like a coward, but maybe it's best not to have the answer for certain, rather than risk hearing what I don't want to hear.
The third thing Yosef realized during his first month back from Moreland City was that his status in Keelan society had changed yet again. As he introduced products and knowledge, became wealthy by Cadellium standards, and was acknowledged for his role in the defense of St. Sidran's Abbey, he became aware of his increased stature. From destitute strange man to major figure in Abersford.
He was recognized by everyone, respected by most, and accepted as somewhat odd. His marriage to Mera, the eldest daughter of the Clan Keelan's hetman, had bumped up his status several steps, with people paying him more deference than in the past. Although those with whom he had the most contact had come back to considering him the same, or nearly so, as before the marriage. Yet he occasionally sensed that even those closest acquaintances acted differently around him, although sometimes the difference was subtle. If he wasn't imagining things, as he often reminded himself, Carnegie remained the one exception. Yosef wondered whether the big man didn't perceive a change in Yosef's position or if he didn't care. Yosef didn't delude himself that he didn't like being seriously listened to, but it got exasperating when people listened because of who he was instead of what he said. The consequences hit home when, while walking through Abersford 2-6 days after returning from Moreland City, he passed a man and a woman, presumably married from their tone of voice, arguing over whether to repaint their house white or brown. Yosef jokingly suggested blue as he passed, never looking back. 3 days later, he passed by the same house, now painted an awful blue. The same man walked out the door as Yosef approached. Although Yosef almost felt afraid to ask, he did.
"Sir, I see you painted your house blue." "Why?"
The man looked startled.
"Why, Sir Kolsko, you said to paint it blue, so..."
"We did."
"Because I suggested it?"
"Well, you're Yosef Kolsko. We figured it must look better if you thought so."
Yosef groaned,
"Christ, it was only a suggestion. Would you have painted it this color if I hadn't said anything?"
The man didn't respond, only stared in confusion at Yosef, who prompted the homeowner again.
"I heard you and your wife discussing either white or brown. I assume you preferred those colors?"
"Yes, I wanted brown, but well, I wanted white. I had almost agreed to the white when you told us blue would be better."
"I only offered an opinion of another color in case you couldn't decide," said Yosef, which was only half true, because he'd given his passing remark in a flippant manner, not meant to be taken seriously.
"In fact, now that I see the blue, you and your wife had the correct idea. The white would look best." The man smiled with obvious relief.
"I'm glad you think so, Sir Kolsko,"
he said, lowering his voice to just above a whisper.
"To be truthful, this color is awful. Our neighbors have already complained about it, and I hate seeing it. We'll go right ahead and repaint the house white as soon as possible."
"Good idea," said Yosef, who wished the man enjoyment of the color change and left before he made another offhand comment that might be taken too seriously. "I gotta be careful what I say," thought Yosef, chagrined. "Hell, can't a man relax into a good mood without worrying about everything coming out of his mouth?" It was several 6 days before the answer became apparent. "No."
"Icon?"
Yosef listened with one ear to Abbot Sistian's God's Day service message. The topic was God's commandment that a person should expect to be treated only as well as he or she treats others. He thought it another statement of the Golden Rule, something similar to "do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Sistian varied this common theme frequently. Usually, Yosef found the variation in approaches to the topic interesting, but the abbot must have been pushed for time because today, Yosef began mouthing the sermon almost word for word. Although what the watchers had done to him gave him an enhanced memory, whether they'd intended the effect or not, it was a sporadic gift. He could recall whole pages, even chapters of science texts he'd used in college, although he ran into annoying gaps. But memories of other topics, such as a political science course, were not as forthcoming. Even if he'd taken the course and read the text, his focus must have been below a minimum threshold, because he could recall only scattered bits, if that. Yet he must have paid special attention when the abbot gave almost exactly the same sermon 2 years previously. Joseph wondered whether anyone else had noticed the similarity. He caught himself mouthing a phrase and Mara watching him, an odd look on her face. Shit. Next thing she'll think I'm reading Sistian's mind. He leaned and whispered in her ear. The abbot's given the same sermon before. She nodded, but he wasn't sure she bought the truth. The service ended with a prayer and a charge to go out and do good, or something close. Yosef was already mentally running through poems and wondering, as long as his memory insisted on bringing up non-science memories, whether he should write snippets of literature as part of a secret journal on the history of Earth. In his mind, he was just finishing the destruction of Sennacherib by Lord Byron when a woman carrying a baby blocked his way down the aisle.
Sir Kolsko, would you bless little soul in here? It means so much to me, you having saved us.
He stared at her. She stood only a few inches shorter than he, stout figure, a plain, pleading face, brown hair gathered into a bun, clean but rough clothing, and holding a sleeping baby perhaps 6 months old. Other attendees flowed around them as Yosef continued staring. Mara nudged him with an elbow. What? He uttered.
A blessing, Sir Kolsko. I know it's probably too much to ask a Septosh after all you've done for us, with the ether helping Sulan be born and the wonderful employment for my husband at the lantern shop.
She broke off, as if hoping for an affirmative answer from Yosef. Mara came to his rescue.
The baby had to be cut from her. It was in breech position and they couldn't turn it. Your ether has made this operation far safer and, needless to say, infinitely less painful.
Yosef didn't ask Mara how she knew details about a woman he didn't recognize. More and more often, he simply took for granted that his wife just knew things.
I'm sorry, Yosef addressed the woman. I'm not a theophist, so I don't know.
Another elbow from Mara, this one sharper than the last.
Oh, for God's sake, put a hand on the baby's head.
Mara hissed in his ear. He did as directed, and the woman beamed back at him, curtsied, and melded into the flow, exiting the cathedral.
What was that all about?
Yosef whispered to Mara.
I'll tell you later.
The next hour they occupy themselves with exchanging greetings and polite conversation with more people than Yosef recognized, though evidently Mara knew them all. Then there was an after-service potluck he hadn't known about. 100 or more people spread out blankets on the grass among trees near the abbey complex. Mara had given Yosef a basket to take with them to the service. He hadn't bothered asking about the contents. They met with Filton Fuller's family, and Carnegie appeared with a wooden block for Mara to sit on, her pregnancy making it difficult to sit upright on a flat surface for more than a few minutes at a time.
Why, thank you, Carnegie. That's very kind of you. Otherwise, I'd have been lying on the ground before long.
Your lot of a husband should have thought of that, said Carnegie.
Well, he has other qualities. Though thinking of the small things isn't necessarily a strong point.
For that snide comment, I've half a mind not to invite you to join us, said Yosef, laughing.
Join you? Well, I didn't bring anything to share, said Carnegie, shifting his feet and looking embarrassed.
Nonsense, said Yosef. If I know Nerlin, she brought enough for 3 times as many people. Meaning that by adding you, there's still enough for twice as many.
Certainly, Carnegie, said Filton's wife. Sit down, and Mara and I will spread out the food.
The group of friends ate,
commented on the service, exchanged words with other clusters of people, and then sat on the grass for another hour while the Fuller children joined the mobs of other children doing what children do. When they departed in various directions, Yosef felt relaxed and almost forgot about the woman asking for a blessing until they came within sight of their house and the memory surfaced. Mara, you were going to tell me what the woman in the cathedral was all about. And what's this Septarsh? I've heard the word before a few times, but haven't had it explained to me. She glanced up at her husband.
It's an ancient word believed to originate somewhere on Melosia. It refers to a person who has a special relationship with God. Exactly what that relationship is seems to vary with how different peoples view a Septarsh. Here on Kedelium and other realms on Anyar, it refers to someone to whom God speaks.
Speaks? Yosef frowned. Like, in a burning bush?
What?
Asked Mara, wrinkling her eyebrows.
Why would God speak from a bush on fire?
Never mind, said Yosef. Couldn't resist, he thought. Though I need to watch getting cute with too many of these snippets.
So God speaks to a Septarsh, said Yosef, changing the topic, as he usually did when he dropped an out-of-context phrase from English into the conversation.
But why did the woman call me one?
I wondered whether you'd noticed the word before, but you never asked me about it or said anything, so I assumed you knew some people have started to associate you with being a Septarsh yourself.
Yosef stumbled in a rut in the road.
Me? Why would anyone think I'm on speaking terms with God?
Yosef, said Mara, with a roll of eyes and an exasperated tone.
Think about it. A strange man appears naked on a beach. He can't speak Kedeli, and yet within a few years, he's introduced products no one has ever heard of and is becoming wealthy. He introduces knowledge unknown on Kedelium and then saves everyone from the Baldorian raiders. At least that's what most people believe. Not long after, he marries the Hetman's daughter and has a major role in turning back the Narthani when they invade Moreland province. Why would you think it strange that at least some people would wonder you're somehow inspired by God?
Well, shit. I can't have people thinking I'm some sort of saint.
Trust me, Yosef, Mara said dryly. Those who know you don't think you're a saint.
He didn't know whether to be relieved or curious enough to ask why not.
Mara, I've tried endlessly to be sure people here know I'm just passing on knowledge from my homeland. It doesn't originate from me, and God certainly isn't telling it to me. Trust me. I'd recognize him if he were.
How exactly would you know it was God?
Well, I don't know. I just would. Her sneer didn't require a verbal explanation of her opinion of his incisive logic. Okay, he conceded. Maybe I don't know how I'd recognize the old guy, but I'm not a Septarsh. I'm just like any other person, but with more knowledge than most people.
Yosef, we haven't been married that long, and I admit I felt uncertain about many aspects of you and your mysterious history, but one thing I do know is you're not just any other person.
He remained silent for almost 100 yards until they were within the bounds of their property when he asked seriously,
"Then what do you think I am?"
"I'm not sure what you are,
with the exception that you're my husband and the father of my child, and I thank God every God's day to have met you."
He pulled her to him with a firm hug, kissing her gently, not saying anything, his throat suddenly tight. Aelian appeared in the veranda and they broke apart. The elderly woman smiled at them.
Still behaving like you just wet? Keep the feeling as long as you can. Brock and I still have it.
Thank merciful God.
Maris claimed that people thought of him as a Septarch, whatever exactly that was, disturbed Yosef enough that he resolved to confirm what she had said with others. The first one was Carnegie.
Yeah, I hear it occasionally. I don't know exactly what a Septarch is supposed to be. I don't pay much attention. Ask Fulton.
Yosef cornered his friend and worker at the distillation shop after midday meal.
Sure, everybody knows about the rumors of you maybe being a Septarch.
What the hell? Everybody but me?
I try not to get into discussions or arguments about it, said Fulton. What do I know about such things? Anyway, who ever heard of a Septarch telling stories at pubs? But that's just me. I know more than a few people who do believe it, or at least consider it possible.
Fulton looked straight at Yosef.
What do you believe? I believe I'm a Septarch about as much as I believe I can pick up Carnegie with one hand.
The same day, after gathering his thoughts about what to ask the abbot, Yosef approached Sistian Bainham's office door. He wanted to assure the chief theophist at St. Sidran's that he made no pretense of being any fashion of holy man, messenger from God, or whatever attribute people might want to foist on him. The abbot motioned for Yosef to take the chair across from his desk, and after the exchanged pleasantries, Sistian said,
"We've had enough conversations in here for me to sense the tenor of what brings you here. From what I see, it's something you're concerned about, not excited."
"It's this nonsense about people thinking I'm something I'm not."
"And that is?"
asked Sistian. Yosef shifted in his seat, uncomfortable with even saying the word.
"A Septarch."
The abbot leaned forward in his chair, folding his hands on the desktop.
"Dear, and I have wondered when you would come to me with this. I will say that I'm a little surprised it took you this long."
Yosef groaned.
"This long? I was hoping it was something new."
"No," said Sistian. "There were murmurs after the Baldurian raid. I suspected it would happen. Then, after the Battle of Moreland City, the rumors have only increased. The impact you've had on Cadellium, with all of your innovations and roles you've played in defending us against our enemies, made it inevitable. There are always people eager to believe a Septarch is among us. Usually a furor over an individual candidate dies down after some precipitating event fades with time, and nothing else happens that's taken as a sign of God's favor."
"I want to assure you, Abbot, I've done nothing to encourage this. I would never pretend to be a religious figure. If I'd realized what was happening, I'd have done something about it."
"It's one of your idiosyncrasies, Yosef. At one moment you present a novel idea or insight, and in the next moment are oblivious to what others see as obvious. Don't tell Mara I told you this, but she once told me you were the most interesting and exasperating person she'd ever met. As for your thinking I might believe that you encourage the Septarch rumors, don't worry, I never thought that. I've always assumed you were unaware and would come to me when you found out. A person who's declared a Septarch is not equated with being a theophist, a saint, or another role involved in direct worship of and service to God. Also be aware that no formal mechanism exists to determine the authenticity of a Septarch, but it's more like a consensus develops among all the people, not only the few who want to believe so hard they grasp at any hint. There have been writings about this, a few that have made their way into the commentaries on the word. It's when those who were skeptical or even opposed to the belief come to firmly accept a person as a Septarch that a consensus develops. At least, that's how it happens on Cadellium. I know it's different in other parts of Anya, and, of course, even the title might be different. In Landolin, such a person would be called a Vajarjunatra. Our word, Septarch, comes from an ancient language and people who no longer exist. The Humari people lived in the south-central part of the Malosia continent. When the Nathani came out of the northern part of the continent after consolidating other tribes, the Humari were the first of the major civilized, as we would call them in comparison, peoples, to fall under the invaders. The Nathani ruthlessly suppressed the Humari. They enslaved those they didn't kill and forbade the Humari to speak their own language. My understanding is that no speaker of Humari has lived for more than 200 years, and their written language exists only in copies outside of Narthon. Cadelli has a few Humari words, Septarch being one of those. Yosef started to ask a question, but Sistine anticipated him and held up a hand. And why do we use the Humari word Septarch on Cadellium? No one knows. Although I suspect the origin is an interesting story. It's lost and somewhere in the past. Yosef remained quiet as he listened, but he spoke up as soon as the abbot paused.
Abbot, how do I stop this?
The abbot shook his head. You can't. In fact, if you made too much of an open effort to discourage such a belief, it would only fuel the rumors. According to our law, one of the characteristics of the true Septarch is a vigorous insistence he or she isn't one.
Well, shit, said Yosef in English.
The abbot laughed. Somehow I don't need to understand your language to suspect the meaning of those words.
So what do I do?
Asked Yosef, discouraged. There's nothing you can do, said Sistian. Just do your best to live your life as if none of this existed or mattered. After all, that's essentially how the word tells us to live, to the best of our ability and without pretense. However, I'd caution you to choose your words carefully, especially around common people. What you say can be taken more seriously than intended.
Oro's City. By coincidence, the same day and 200 miles north, another conversation occurred about the Septarch question. The Bolteki were one of the smallest clans in population, and their landlocked mountainous province bordered seven other clans, more than any other clan. This proximity, their position next to Oro's in the conclave site, and the marriage of the Bolteki hetman's eldest son to a daughter of the Oro's hetman all contributed to the Bolteki hetman being one of the more astute students of inter-clan relations and political currents. On this particular day, Teres Bolteki and Thomas Oros had excused themselves from their respective spouses and other family members to retire to the Oros Manor balcony outside the main room. The intermarried families lived 50 miles apart and managed reciprocal visits several times a year. The evening meal finished, the women had shooed the children out to play for an hour before dark to allow the two hetmen to discuss clan affairs.
I needed this visit, Thomas, said Teres Bolteki. Seeing the families together and all the children always lightens my mood, although it seems to get harder every month.
The Narthani, stated Oros, sharing his friend and fellow hetman's thoughts. I also have trouble getting them out of my mind. What Yosef Kolsko told us when we met after the battle is right. The Narthani aren't going away. We only drove them back, but what about next time?
Yes, we won at Moreland City, said Oros, at a terrible price for the Moreland clan, and let's be honest. We had more a share of luck than we had any reason to expect or are likely to get again. College Keelan said the same to me before returning to Keelan after the battle. The plan suggested by the Skolsko worked out, and the Tri-Alliance clansmen made heroic efforts, but it still took two incredibly stupid mistakes to gain the victory. If either the Morlanders hadn't held the Nathani attention or the Iwalese hadn't left their position, we might be having a very different conversation.
Balteki grunted agreement.
Where does this leave us? We cooperated at Moreland City and afterward until the Nathani were back deep in Iwo territory. Then we all returned home and are doing what?
Waiting for the next Nathani move, answered Oros.
And then what? Who knows if all the same clans will respond to the next call, much less the clans that didn't this time. And then hours of argument about what to do.
Oros glanced at the closed balcony door to be sure no one overheard what he was about to say. He leaned closer to Balteki.
I spoke of this briefly with College Keelan before he left Moreland City. Since then, we've exchanged several letters, ones I've burned after reading. I'll share the salient points with you. This needs to be kept between us, for the time being. Keelan has some radical ideas. At this point, it's just talk. But with all we face with the Nathani, the more I think about it, the more I believe it's something to keep under consideration. Keelan believes the only way we can drive the Nathani off Cadellium is to unify all the clans under some form of central control. He doesn't know how that can easily happen, though one thought he's had is that if the clans could rally around a central authority, they might be willing to cede control temporarily to drive the Nathani off the island.
A central authority?
Like who or what? It couldn't be a hetman. Too many of the clansmen would never take orders from another clan's hetman. Even getting them to listen to advice from another can be discouraging. It would have to be someone else. The only figure so widely respected is Redri Brisson, but he is not someone to lead the fight against the Nathani.
The Theophist was highly regarded and revered throughout Cadellium and assumed to be a candidate to be named a Septarch for his additions to the commentaries that accompanied the word.
I agree, said Oros. However, Keeler and I think it might be possible for Brisson to act as a spiritual leader, supporting a temporary central leadership, perhaps a group of three or four headmen who would plan whatever we do against the Nathani. Then the other clans would be obliged to follow the plan.
Balteki stroked his beard while one eyebrow raised.
I can see that working in theory, but in practice, I don't know. Would Brisson agree? He might, if it was presented to him as the best hope to save our peoples.
Oros looked around again, still no one else in hearing range.
Keelan has another thought, this one more speculative. You've heard the stories of this Joseph Kolsko, how he came to Cadellium, all the changes he's influenced, and his role at Moreland City.
Moreland City, of course, replied Balteki. And the kerosene lanterns and other things he's brought to Cadellium, but only partial reports about the raid at St. Sidran's Abbey. I assume you've heard the rumors about Kolsko being a Septarch? My own cousin is convinced Kolsko is an agent of God sent to deliver us from the Nathani. Then again, my cousin is not the brightest member of our family and is constantly dreaming up fantastical plots and mysteries.
Yet he's not the only clan member wondering if it might not be true. It does seem unlikely that a strange man shows up on Cadellium with innovations and advice on defeating the Nathani just when we're under such a dire threat.
Oro shrugged.
A skeptic would say it's a coincidence, while someone grasping for a hoped for help from God could easily assign the role to this Kolsko fellow. Whatever the truth, Keelan wonders if Kolsko might also serve as a unifying figure, maybe not leading, but giving advice. His warnings about not attacking the Nathani line directly at Moorland City and his plans for the flank attack give him a reputation as someone to listen to.
I don't know, said Bolteki. He's not from Cadellium, and he's married into Hetman Keelan's family, so it's difficult to be sure how these factors will affect whether Hetman would follow such advice, although I agree he has considerable influence at the moment.
Yes, it's hard to predict, said Oros, although there's certain to be an all-clan conclave coming soon. That's where such issues will be raised.
And argued and argued, said Bolteki.
Oros laughed.
At a meeting with all the hetman? What else would you expect?